Hello and welcome to Spy Hards Podcast, where your hosts go deep undercover into the world of spy movies to decipher which films make the knock list. But remember, this information is strictly for your ears only. I'm Agent Scott.
And I'm Cam the Provocateur. And Scott, get undressed. Strip. All your clothes. Now.
Do you want my keys and my motorcycle too?
Yes, please. Vroom, vroom, baby.
We're adding two very different films together there, folks, by the way. I was hoping you wouldn't use that line, because that's my outro.
Is it? Well, there's so few lines to quote in this one.
There is so few, but I'm sure I'll pull one out of my butt. But before we get to talking about the film, we need to induct our latest Spy Hards, Die Hard. And if you're wondering what that is, Cam, why don't you tell them?
Well, of course, yes, you can become a Spy Hards diehard by leaving a 5-star review for us on Apple Podcasts, and then we read it on the show and give you your top secret Spy Hards diehards nickname.
Cam really bigs up the nickname part of it. I mean, for me, it was more just a way of interacting with you all and hearing what you thought about the show. And then Cam wants to now give you all cool, allegedly cool nicknames. You could decide if you want to keep the nickname or not. It's not legally binding, folks.
That's true. Yes.
But this week's review comes from the UK Apple Podcast. The user is Flows, 1986.
Okay.
Insert spy-based pun here. 5 stars. Our introduction to this pod was episode 33. Right from the off, the choice of guests and her story about her field can reconcile with the study and enjoyment of James Bond was gripping. A great movie podcast with a unique take.
Well, thank you very much. That's awesome.
Well, for those of you who aren't keeping track on our episode numbers, although they are there, episode number 33 was Our The World Is Not Enough review, and our special guest was Dr. Lisa Funnell, and she actually teaches Bond as part of the curriculum at the school she teaches at and writes a lot about Bond too. It's a great episode, and if you haven't checked that one out, I'd recommend you all go back and check it out. But thank you for the review. Cam, do you have a special nickname for our reviewee?
Okay, well, Flows 1986, not a bad nickname. But I think I have a better one that ties into a little bit of a plot element or story element of today's movie. Your new secret agent codename is Laser Hacker.
Laser Hacker?
That's right. There is a point in this movie where someone hacks a computer using a laser.
Infrared.
And I think Laser Hacker. Infrared, yeah. Laser Hacker. That's a pretty cool code nickname.
For those keeping track, that's Cam very much clutching at straws there.
This was one of the most difficult ones ever, but I think I pulled out gold.
Well, Flows 1986, or Laser Hacker, as I'm sure your legal name will now be. You let us know if you're happy with that Spy Hards Die Hards nickname. Make sure you enter the club, folks. Leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. But let's get down to it. Cam, let's talk about the film. Well, here we are, folks. We are in the very lovely, luscious, and comfortable UN building. I can't wait to talk about this week's film. Cam, what do we got?
Yes, we are tackling the year 2000 film, The Art of War, starring Wesley Snipes, one of the kind of star vehicles that he led coming out of Blade.
Are you telling me this film came out in the year 2000?
Yeah, you wouldn't have guessed, would you?
No. No.
Is this the most year 2000 movie we've ever tackled on the show?
It's either this or a film that's actually a close relative of this, which is Kiss of the Dragon.
Yeah, that one I feel like maybe had a little bit of one foot in the past, whereas like this movie is just like 2000s hit the gas.
Well, even one of the characters who's assassinated very early on, played by the wonderful James Hong, even says, is it Y2K? Why is the computer crashed? And I'm like, no, don't take me back to Y2K. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah, this is very much a companion piece of sorts to The World Is Not Enough if you are traveling in spy circles.
In terms of a companion piece, is this the bit that you sort of are given? Like, is this the mint at the end of the meal where you might not really want it?
Yes. Yes, it is. It's also like, I mean, let's be honest, while it is a year 2000 movie, so not that old really in the scheme of things in terms of the movies we tackle on the show, in some ways this is a Spy Hard special because I don't know how many people really recall The Art of War these days, although I mean, there are obviously a couple direct-to-video sequels.
Well, let's put it this way. I put a blast out on Twitter earlier today that I was watching this. Now, I'm not saying I'm a master of Twitter.
Don't be so humble.
Well,
come on.
Well, I said, has anyone, you know, anyone got any thoughts on this film? I got two replies, and one of them was, I've never heard of it.
And that was Wesley Snipes.
probably more likely to be Wesley Snipes' banker.
Mm. Oh. That's some edgy topical material there, Scott.
You know me, I keep it on trend. Well, if you haven't heard of, and it sounds like it could be quite a few of you, The Art of War, let me give you a lesson. Here is your synopsis.
Actually, Scott, I would prefer you just gave a beat-by-beat plot synopsis of this movie for my benefit.
Oh, okay.
I kid.
I wasn't prepared for this.
I kid.
We could be here a while, folks. Strap in. Here it is. The Art of War. Do you know who your enemy is? Now, it always starts me off on a bad foot when they always go with that sort of nothing is as it seems.
Yeah.
It just feels like lazy writing. But anyway, and I think Wesley Snipes does say nothing is as it seems in this film at one point, and it gave me horrible flashbacks to that Al Pacino film.
Oh, okay.
The one I forgot existed that I can't remember the name of.
The Recruit?
Yes.
Okay. I was thinking of like other bad Wesley Snipes dialogue around this time period, and I think of Murder at 1600, where he's on the radio. We've got a murder at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, or whatever the address is. I think that's what it is. I may be wrong about that. But anyways, he goes, an address that changes all the rules.
Over the radio?
Yeah.
The dispatcher's like, could you clear the line, please? I'm trying to respond.
Yes, we know it changes all the rules. We don't need to be told that.
But this is the day it changes. I know! Okay, well, let's give you the rest of the synopsis. When ruthless terrorists threaten to bring down the United Nations, they frame the one man they believe can stop them, an international security expert named Shaw. Now he must run from his own allies and become a solitary force for good as he tries to stop what could become World War III. Did you get any sense of there being World War III impending in this film?
I didn't really... I got more of the sense that there was going to be like a breakup of a trade agreement.
Yeah, it felt like a Phantom Menace with a spy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like, okay, the trade agreement is bringing some like unity between, you know, China and like the West. So I'm like, okay, I guess the idea of if that agreement dissolves, then there could be conflict. Yes, I definitely was along for the ride there. But like World War III never really had that vibe.
There was never like the shot of the president and his finger on the button.
No.
You know, like, oh, I should blow them up or whatever.
Yeah.
This is a synopsis that's written by someone, not necessarily the people that wrote the film, so I can't throw that at the film. I can just throw it at whoever wrote that synopsis.
Yeah. But, I mean, ultimately, that is a relatively accurate synopsis in terms of the overall intention of the film.
And I mean, as a premise, I both love and hate this film. In the sense that the UN, the United Nations, has a secret, like, James Bond-esque force with a license to kill that has global overreach.
Yeah.
I think that could be really cool.
I feel like we're already diving into the movie before we do anything, but, like, is that premise... almost like too kind of like campy and silly for the movie that they're attaching it to, which is like talking about trade agreements and like a lot of political complications.
See, now I just can't get the Phantom Menace out of my head. It's two of them. Oh, no. The Droidicas. No, I think actually this premise has legs. I'm not
and
saying
they're kicking.
They're kicking one way or another. Could be upstream, could be downstream. We don't know just yet. But let's talk about how this war began.
Well, before we get there, had you ever seen this movie or heard of it in the past?
Cam, I covered that. No one has.
Oh, well, okay. But to be fair, I actually have memories of this coming up.
Oh, okay. Well, you've ruined my, like, train there. But okay, go on. You have memories. Take us back to the angsty 2000s, Cam.
Because I had to ask myself, like, why did I not see this movie? Because, like, I was a huge fan of Blade.
I can answer that.
I saw Blade. I was a big fan of Wesley Snipes. Passenger 57 was one of those formative action movies of my younger years. I skipped Murder at 1600, but I did rent it from the library when it came out. So, like, Wesley Snipes was someone who, if his name was on a movie, I had an interest in seeing what he was doing. But I do remember this movie coming out, and everything about it looked like a movie I did not want to watch. There was no part of me that was like, even at the age of 19, I guess I would have been, was like, oh, Wesley Snipes in a kind of action movie? I don't want to see this. There's nothing about this movie that interests me.
If only Cam in 2024 could have the precognition abilities of Wesley Snipes in this film to see that reaction to it ahead of time.
You know, this is what I was so excited to cover on the show, though, because right. It's like I get to go back in time and watch this completely random Wesley Snipes movie that I skipped over as a youth.
Did you at least like surround yourself with 2000s era accoutrement, like a big old, you know, gallon bottle of Mountain Dew or something and some Doritos, or I don't know what you were into in 2000?
Crystal Pepsi? No, that might have been a little earlier.
That's the 80s, I think, Cam. Jesus.
No, it's not the 80s, because I was drinking it in high school. So that's like the late 90s.
Okay. Let us know, folks, when was Crystal Pepsi?
Pepsi Max. I was drinking a lot of Pepsi Max while I was watching this.
Actually, I was too, so that's fair.
Is it still around?
Pepsi Max? Yeah, we drink it all the time here.
Oh, okay. Because that was like kind of a big deal in like the late 90s, early 2000s.
What's your like Coke Zero equivalent for Pepsi?
Maybe it is called... I don't drink Pepsi very much, so maybe it is called Pepsi Max. I don't know.
It's my favorite of all the colas.
Oh, we have Pepsi Zero, I think.
Oh, we don't have that. We have Pepsi Max.
Sorry, Wesley Snipes. This is where it's gone.
I mean, Wesley Snipes is the Pepsi Max of colas, so I guess I drink a lot of him. I drink a lot of Wesley Snipes.
That's right.
Yum, yum. What's happened?
I don't know.
Let's get back to it. How did we get... Because obviously you've got a connection. You recall the film. I understand that. We've grounded it for the people. Let's bring it back home. How did this war begin?
Okay, so it began as a story and screenplay. So a writer named Wayne Beach came up with this film concept. And he had actually written Murder at 1600. In 1997, or co-wrote it. And so I initially was like, well, clearly that he's the reason that Wesley Snipes is in this movie. They must have had a relationship, but it gets a little more complicated than that. So he wrote Murder at 1600. This is his follow-up to that film. And then he only did one other credit at all. In 2005, he did a crime thriller, independent crime thriller. He wrote and directed it. And it was, from what I heard, pretty much a ripoff of The Usual Suspects. Right. Called Slow Burn, starring Ray Liotta, LL Cool J, Mekhi Phifer, Taye Diggs, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Star Trek Enterprise star Jolene Blaylock.
That sounds like a real Coke Zero.
That's a pretty all-star cast, though, and they are getting a lot of these people when they're young and not that expensive.
I'm more of a Pepsi Max guy, Cam.
Okay, that's fair. But yeah, I've never really heard of Slow Burn, but I was intrigued after I discovered it. But originally, like, the project was picked up off of that screenplay, and Jet Li was attached to star in it. And this would be Jet Li coming off of Lethal Weapon 4, so they're looking for vehicles for him to work in. And so this movie was what they looked at for Jet Li, but instead he ended up doing the same year as this, Romeo Must Die. And that instead was more of his starring vehicle launch point in North America.
Okay. I think he chose wisely with that.
Yeah, I agree. I think, like, Romeo Must Die is also very year 2000 and not particularly good, but it still, I think, was more of a recognizable hit at the box office than this.
I think it's also more attuned to Jet Li. I think this is very dialogue-heavy for Wesley Snipes, and I'm not sure Jet Li has that. I mean, yeah, we had him in what was the film I mentioned earlier?
Kiss of the Dragon.
Kiss of the Dragon, and they made a point to make him very monosyllabic,
like stoic. Yeah, yeah, like kind of like Man of Mystery, which is what they also did in like The One, where he was like a villain, but he was like pretty quiet. He was more of a man of action, whereas like this movie. Wesley Snipes has to give a lot of exposition and stuff, and I don't know if that is Jet Li's strength at that point in time.
No, no. So I think that worked out well.
Yeah. And so, like, after Jet Li passed, Wesley Snipes becomes attached and is an exec producer on this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So he obviously has a fair amount of ownership. His production company put this film out as well. So, like, Wesley Snipes is quite invested. They brought in another writer named Simon Barry, who was actually one of your countrymen. He was born in London.
Don't blame me for this.
And his previous credit to this was a 1998 softcore thriller called Faithless. And then he jumped from Faithless right into The Art of War. But since then, he's actually done quite well. He's created the TV shows Continuum, Bad Blood, Ghost Wars, and Warrior Nun. So he continues to work to this day, but more in TV, not a big theatrical film career.
Those titles track with this film, sure.
Did you ever watch Continuum? Wasn't it quite popular?
I can't say I never watched it, but you should have, Cam, because it was set in Vancouver.
Oh, that's right. Rachel Nichols was the star of it, wasn't she?
Rachel Nichols. Yes, she was a star.
I only remember that because the year that this show came out, she came to the Vancouver Fan Expo promoting it.
Ah, I've never heard of Rachel Nichols.
Okay, she's in Star Trek 2009. She was the Orion. She's had quite a few film credits, though.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay, that's how I know her. Fine.
Yes, so Simon Barry rewrote the Wayne Beach draft of the screenplay, and originally, they were looking at a different director. They were originally looking to hire Stanley Tong, who had directed Jackie Chan's First Strike, which we talked about fairly recently on the show. And he would have been coming off of Mr. Magoo at this point in time. So they were looking at this as being his follow-up American film after the somewhat disaster of Mr. Magoo. But he instead chose to go do the Hong Kong action film China Strike Force instead, perhaps because his experience making Mr. Magoo was so dire.
Where do you go after Magoo?
Indeed, yes. So, like, Stanley Tong, Hong Kong-trained action director, right? Like, that's kind of what you're looking for, I think, for the vibe of what this movie is setting out to achieve.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got that sort of heartbeat to it.
Yeah, like, it's very influenced, you can tell, from, like, around that era, the stuff like John Woo, Tsui Hark, Ringo Lam, all those guys coming to American film. And this movie has a lot of that kind of style going about. So Stanley Tong makes a lot of sense. But Stanley Tong, not interested. So instead they hired Christian Duguay, who is a Quebec-born director, who's the exact opposite of any of those men.
Well, they do call him the next best thing to Hong Kong.
I suppose so. So he started out as a Steadicam operator in the film industry and went on to direct over a dozen episodes of the late 80s TV action show Crossbow, which was sort of a riff on William Tell.
I mean, okay, folks, this is audio, right?
Yes.
And Cam just looked at me like I should know what Crossbow is. He gave me the same look that I should know about what that show based in Vancouver. Does he think I spend all day watching television?
Yes. Yes, I do.
And no, I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the listeners. Shut up. No one wants to hear from you. I want to hear from you folks. Have you heard of both of these shows that he's talking about? If you have, you've stamped your bingo card, let us know because I don't think you exist.
Did Crossbow do the legend of William Tell justice, Scott?
I've never seen it. Or I'm not even sure who William Tell is.
Isn't he the guy that shot the apple off the other person's head?
I just told you I don't know.
Fair enough.
His acts aren't gonna do it. How does that help?
So anyways, Christian Duguay goes on from his Crossbow glory to direct a couple sequels to the movie Scanners. He does Scanners 2 and 3. And then he does the Pierce Brosnan film Livewire and the Peter Weller sci-fi film Screamers, which I actually recall quite well. That one was sort of a fun B-movie. He did the 1997 espionage film The Assignment, which we're going to tackle on the show. And The Art of War was actually his follow-up to the like quite acclaimed and quite popular 1999 TV miniseries Joan of Arc, starring Lily Sobieski.
I only know one of the films you just mentioned because I've seen a clip of Livewire before where I think Pierce Brosnan is like fighting with a clown who has a bomb in his belly and has to throw him off the side of something and he explodes. It's quite outrageous.
I've never seen Livewire, but Screamers was a lot of fun when I saw it in 1995. I don't know how it holds up. Mm. But this guy's filmography is Hired Gun, you know, that kind of stuff.
And joining us later this week. not just yet. Maybe for the next film, folks.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe the assignment is going to knock our socks off and we'll have a lot to dive into with that one.
Look who's shading in their review now.
Haven't seen it, so I don't know.
I meant this film.
He really only did one major theatrical film after this, which was called Extreme Ops, and it was a movie about basically snowboarders taking down terrorists. I saw it on a date. It was terrible, and it was with Devon Sawa.
You took a date to go see Extreme Ops?
Her pick, not mine.
When you said Extreme Ops, I did my brain sort of try to figure out what the film was, and I had it as surgeons doing X Games.
No.
Like they were cutting someone on a half pipe?
No, it is a movie that very much comes out of that X Games kind of world, though.
Yeah, okay. I like my idea more.
Yes, and actually it co-stars Liliana Komorowska, who the director was married to at the time, and she's a co-star of this film as well.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Yeah. But since then, he's done some like very acclaimed TV because he did the program Human Trafficking with Mira Sorvino, Coco Chanel with Shirley MacLaine, and is since then, after like a fair amount of success in TV, he got a number of primetime Emmy nominations. Mm-hmm. Since then, has worked more in France, making films there. So I think Extreme Ops and The Art of War maybe were kind of the exit points for the major film industry.
Well, he had his slice of the cake.
He did indeed.
Let's be positive. He contributed to cinema history, to Hollywood, to Western cinema history with some films. Whether you like them or not, here they are.
That's right. And so Wesley Snipes, who's exec producer on this film, talked in an interview about how like he was very much influenced to do this by his love of Alfred Hitchcock films and Harrison Ford thrillers. He really liked the idea of kind of like the political thriller and bringing in action because he talked about, of course, his love of martial arts as well. Mm-hmm. But he had an interesting quote where he basically ended the interview with saying, "You're not going to see me in Blade 14. So it's like very clear that like Wesley Snipes, despite being kind of brought back into popularity by Blade, not necessarily in love with the Blade experience and looking to commit long term.
I mean, just couldn't get that red dye out of his hair.
Ugh. I just bought Blade on 4K yesterday, so I'm looking forward to revisiting it. But it's interesting because like Wesley Snipes had kind of like struggled leading up to Blade. Like his career had been a little bit up and down, and that was very much a comeback. And it's interesting how he's like kind of not that interested in making that an ongoing thing, more seeing as that to like kind of a launch pad to doing other things he's interested in.
Had he done 2 and 3 at this point?
Not 2 yet. He would have, I think, probably known he's going to be doing 2.
Right. And yet he says that in the press interview. Very interesting. I don't mind the Blade films, although I can never forgive the third one.
No, it's not good.
Mostly for hiring Triple H as an actor. That's bad enough. Sure. And then for having vampire Pomeranians.
Yeah.
I saw it in theaters and I just wanted to, you know, gouge my own eyes out and feed it to vampires.
I was a fan of the first two, but the third one was so lousy.
It's just a complete departure from what they were doing.
I've never really understood Wesley Snipes because he's someone who is like classically trained, a great dramatic actor. You see him in like his Spike Lee films, White Men Can't Jump. You're like, this guy is a movie star. Mm. And then he kind of like just went down this action route and some of them were good, but like he was capable of so much more. And like you see him in like the Eddie Murphy film, You Can Call Me Dolomite, I think it was called. But like he has a supporting role in that and steals the entire movie. He's absolutely incredible. And you're like, this guy's got it. Why does he give himself in this era so much generic action stuff?
I'm just checking up on the name of that film for you because I think you got it wrong.
I think I did too.
But I did see that film and it is a good film. Dolomite Is My Name was the film.
Thank you.
Yeah, and he was good in that actually. I can attest to that. Although, I mean, in terms of other actors in history that have done the same thing. I my mind goes to James Coburn.
Okay. Yeah.
Good dramatic actor, but then went down this sort of martial arts route because he was very interested in martial arts. But he did keep doing his dramatic roles throughout his career at the same time. He did sort of do both. I don't think he sort of pigeonholed himself into action.
Well, you could also look at Nicolas Cage, who like suddenly starts doing The Rock and Con Air and Face Off, but he's still working in interesting kind of side roles.
But that's where the money is, though. Like,
what
was it, David Lynch? Wild at Heart is not going to get him money, but mm-hmm. Con Air is.
Totally. Yeah. And so, like, I appreciate when, like, an actor is able to kind of wander in both worlds. But, like, Wesley Snipes, who is so capable of being in incredible films and giving great performances, just seemed bored a lot on screen and when he's doing movies like this or Murder at 1600.
Well, I can tell you ahead of time of the review, he's not the person who's most bored in this film.
That is true. I've got a few other candidates for that list there.
Uh-huh.
So this movie had a budget of $60 million, which is actually quite a lot for the year 2000.
That's quite a lot.
They invested big in The Art of War.
I mean, it's got the sort of slow-mo trying to be the Matrix scene. That's got to cost some money.
Yeah. Yeah, some location work, that's expensive. Yeah,
there's some stunt stuff that's not awful.
Yeah, so the movie made domestically $30.2 million, international $10.2 million, for a worldwide total of $40.4 million.
Yikes.
Yeah, it landed number 86 for the year between Bless the Child, which was a Kim Basinger horror film, and then it was one spot above Dancer in the Dark, which was the Bjork musical film by Lars von Trier.
I didn't know that other one existed.
Yeah, it was actually quite acclaimed, Dancer in the Dark. But top three for the year, we talked about it not so long ago. Number one was Mission Impossible 2. Mm. Number two was Gladiator. Number three was Castaway. And a couple final notes. Art of War scored big at the Canadian Society of Cinematographers Awards. It won Best Cinematography in a Theatrical Feature, which I thought was fascinating. And so I did a little bit of a dive to see what the other nominees were.
I was hoping you would.
Yeah, one of them was Final Destination with Devin Sawa, bringing it back. Mm. And the other movie was a movie called Eve, which is sort of a take on the Adam and Eve legend. And the poster looks it looks like a softcore film. Scott's frantically searching for that poster.
I can tell you, folks, I've got my eyes on Eve and I can't take my eyes away. I am Adam Meyering.
Looks like quite the feature. Quite the feature.
Well, folks, I can assure you that it is only an hour and 15 minutes.
So you can watch it twice in very little time.
But back to it, Cam. Any other notes on Art of War?
Just lastly, I mentioned it earlier, but Art of War, not a box office success, but was one of those movies, like, you know, some others around that time, you know, or later Jarhead, Undisputed. They did not great in theaters, but spawned several sequels in the direct-to-video world.
Sure.
And so in 2008, you had The Art of War 2 Betrayal, which Wesley Snipes came back for, that got a very small release in theaters in Japan and nowhere else. And then in 2009, the year after, you had The Art of War 3 Retribution, where Wesley Snipes did not come back. And so the rapper Treach took over the lead role, and Treach was actually one of the members of Naughty by Nature back in the day. I have not seen either of these movies, but they definitely exist.
And I can confirm we aren't covering them.
We'll be watching Eve before we watch The Art of War 3.
Yeah. If you see that coming up on your podcast player, the next week will be Art of War 2.
That's right.
Okay, well, that sounds like that's our behind the scenes. We know how the war got started. Now let's paint our masterpiece, The Art of War. What do we think of it? Cam, as you have a bit of history with it, why don't you lead us off?
This is just the like total epitome of like the trashy action movies of the year 2000 or early on, you know, like the early 2000s. It has all of the hallmarks. It has that kind of music video editing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of martial arts scenes with Wesley Snipes. And Wesley Snipes talks so much about his martial arts skills and wanting to showcase them, you know, on film. And we saw it in Blade. But, like, I'm watching the movie here going, I don't think Wesley Snipes did a lot of these martial arts, because the way they're editing this, it's very clearly, like, stunt doubles stepping in.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of just obnoxious filters being thrown on. There's flashback sequences that are being cut at the same time as a chase. So you're actually having flashbacks to an earlier chase while you're watching a current chase. One of them is done in like this very like shoddy looking black and white filter. And it's like, oh my God, I am having a year 2000 hallucinogenic experience. So, I mean, it is just total action trash. But here's the problem with The Art of War. I have no problem with action trash. I will sign up.
The first bit wasn't the problem. This is the problem. Okay.
I will sign up for like trashy action movies just about any day of the week, right?
Yeah.
If they're fun and they keep me engaged, I don't care. I'll sit through The Mechanic Resurrection and be like, you know what? At the end of the day, kind of fun. The problem with The Art of War is it's incredibly self-serious. And it's very bogged down in sort of the political machinations of the film that are never interesting and never particularly compelling. Like, they never portray them in a way where you're actually engrossed in the information you're hearing. It's like you're just listening to exposition bots talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the other issue. Wesley Snipes talked about how he was really inspired by Harrison Ford thrillers. And, you know, Harrison Ford has done movies like Presumed Innocent or Frantic, which are kind of these adult thrillers that I could see drawing influence from. But that's not the movie I thought of while I was watching this. I kept thinking of The Fugitive.
Yeah.
And, like, The Fugitive DNA is all over this movie.
Wall to
wall. It's like, imagine if you made The Fugitive with no tension.
Yeah.
And with Tommy Lee Jones replaced by a different, you know, FBI agent in this case, who's just kind of like wandering through the movie, not caring. And that's the Maury Chaykin character, who never seems that invested in really tracking him down, kind of wanders through the movie. And you're like, okay, you've just removed all tension of the cat and mouse. And so, like, what am I watching? I'm watching Wesley Snipes just kind of go on the run and seem really bored. And that's how I felt. I was very bored through great sections of this movie.
I'll get into my thoughts in a second, but I was so bored during this film that I came up with alternate titles. So I had The Art of Snore.
That's good.
The Art of Bore.
Also great.
And The Art of... Core blimey, this one's taken a while.
Art of... This is a chore.
Oh, chore. I should have thought of that. I kept the rhyme up. Well done. Yeah. You mentioned the lack of tension and things like The Fugitive. And the police officer is a great point of comparison, but you also compare it to something like The Day of the Jackal, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily for the plot, but for the chase. And if you took the Michael Lonsdale character from The Day of the Jackal and told him to go as lackadaisical as you physically could with the role, like pretend it's your last day on the force and you don't want to get in trouble, you are keeping your head down, can you imagine the tension of that film working at all?
No, and his character is vital, I think, to this movie working.
Yeah.
Because, like, your main villain is obscured through the majority of the runtime. So it's not like you are able to have a specific threat that is pursuing Wesley Snipes through the film, where you go, okay, well, look, the detective or FBI agent in this case is not particularly intrepid in pursuing him, but at least I understand that this other threat is pursuing him. So I'm getting tension there. But they're obscuring everything going on with the big bad, so you don't know what's going on there. So you are actually relying on the FBI agent to be the person that's pursuing Wesley Snipes. Because otherwise, you just have, in this case, a lot of random, like, triad members and assassins popping up randomly, but there's never a sense they're tracking him moment to moment.
No, and there's also, if those things don't work, so say your two like primary drivers are your are villains in this film, if they're not working, you at least need to have like a compelling lead or a great chemistry between the lead and his sidekick. Whereas everyone in this film is so aloof.
Yeah.
They you said like they're treating with a large amount of reverence, right? They think this is some high art that they're in, and brother, they're not in high art. They're in some low budget 2000s wannabe The Matrix, wannabe The Fugitive action kung fu film. If they'd realized that and lent into it, this could have been a lot more fun. It should have just turned up the fun dial, but it just isn't fun.
And it's not low budget, actually. Like $60 million, this was actually a pretty big investment. So I think in their minds, they went in thinking, like, this is something like The Fugitive. And didn't Wesley Snipes make U.S. Marshals, like, a couple years before this?
Yeah.
So, like, Wesley Snipes has already been in a Fugitive knockoff, and frankly, something,
a better one.
A better one than this, yeah.
Yeah. We haven't done U.S. Marshals yet, but we will. I guess I'll pivot on to my overall thoughts. And it's interesting when my own note-taking process goes meta.
Mm.
I've never had this experience before. This is the first time it's happened. So I usually write my big thoughts at the end of writing my notes. I've written everything else down, my interesting tidbits, my likes and my dislikes. And that sort of allows me to convalesce everything together into one cohesive thought. And so I wrote the following. An interesting premise, though slightly comical, completely spoiled by, and then my pen ran out of ink. Which actually connects very well to this film, because it runs out of steam about 10 minutes into it.
Yeah.
You get a really cool intro sequence where he's like infiltrating a New Year's Eve party and does some James Bond style stuff, has a like a kung fu fight with some baddies. I was, in those first 10 minutes, I was like, oh, this, maybe the IMDb score is wrong. This could be a secret, you know, one of those five fingers, oh my God, I can't believe this is making the knock list, wow, type films. And then it just goes completely off the rails, and not in a fun, interesting way like Casino Royale 67, in a boring way like Trenchcoat.
And like, I think a big part of the problem is like Wesley Snipes seems really bored in this movie. Like, he was the Daywalker in Blade. He's the Sleepwalker in The Art of War.
Oh, very good. Very good, Cam. Golf clap for this man. Golf clap.
It's like he just has this hardened kind of exterior in this movie, and it's a problem.
He's saying he's stiff.
It's a problem because, like, Harrison Ford in The Fugitive, you get a real sense of the human being he, like Richard Kimball, is over the course of that journey. Like, you're very sympathetic to his journey. Like, you care.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, Wesley Snipes is just, he's just all, like, granite in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you have him paired with, like, you know, a female lead played by Marie Matico, who plays Julia in this movie. And, like, she's someone who's an interpreter that is thrown into this terrible circumstance and along for the ride, not necessarily dissimilar from something like The Bourne Identity with another character.
Sure.
Actually, that was a Marie character, whereas this character is played by Marie. Weird connection.
I wonder if that's connected.
I doubt it. But I mean, like, she is, I think, trying. Like, this is a relatively new actor at this point in time, and she's paired with Wesley Snipes, and I definitely felt like she was trying to inject energy into this character, but she's bouncing off of nothing. And I think they're trying to sell that there's a little bit of like a slow burn romantic connection here, given the ending of the film. That is absent on screen. These two have no chemistry whatsoever, and there's no kind of gradually developing sense of warmth the way there is in something like The Bourne Identity.
Mm-hmm.
She's treated like kind of just like a rag doll being dragged around a lot by Wesley Snipes.
Yep.
And it's like, it's a real issue, because like Wesley Snipes is just giving you so little. He just seems so bored.
I don't know if he was necessarily bored when he was making it. I don't know if that was the intention in his performance. I think it was more of a case of he thought he was making, I'm trying to think of a 90s equivalent of a realistic spy drama. There's not that many. It's a very fantastical era.
Yeah.
But The Bourne Identity is 2 years later.
Right.
I would almost argue this film needed to go through the Bourne Identity process of being grounded. And I think you might have got a better film out of it, because the world around them is wacky,
mm-hmm.
but they're playing it straight.
It is incredibly wacky, because like the whole setup of that UN Secret Service group or whatever they're called, that agency, like,
it's the United Nations Covert Operations Unit.
What's the acronym for that?
UNCU.
UNCU. The man from UNCU.
I mean, you could have done something. Yeah, the man from UNCU. There we go. That's the nickname for this episode, folks. The man from UNCU.
But you have that set up, going back to my nickname for, you know, the review lever for this episode. But, like, we have them hacking a computer with an infrared laser beam. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. Like, there's some really silly stuff.
Well, that is realistic, though. There was a data transfer system via infrared back in the early noughties.
Was there really?
And late. Yeah. It was because we didn't have USB wasn't all that popular at that point. USB 1 at that time. Infrared was actually a much faster way of sending small packet data between devices. So yes, I even think some phones had infrared. And I believe there was a handheld games console that had an infrared beam that allowed you... was it the Game Boy? Maybe not the Game Boy, maybe one of the later ones. But yeah, they had an infrared system and you could just put them next to each other and send data that way. They were close in close proximity to one another. It wasn't literally done with a red beam. That's more just for cinema language.
Sure.
But infrared was a data sending and retrieval device.
Well, consider me corrected. Art of War, you've just made the knock list.
You just got schooled. You just got uncooed.
But yeah, you like kick off that intro, and they're like, there's some really goofy stuff. It's like this party thrown by the character David Chan, who they say is the Trump of Asia, which is...
that's my second note, the Donald Trump of Asia.
I thought it was weird he was selling Bibles. That was kind of outside the...
Now, look who's being relevant now.
But he's played by Kerry Hiroyuki Tagawa, who of course played Shang Tsung in Mortal Kombat and was in License to Kill. He's one of those character actors who's all over the place. I love this man. He's great every time he pops up. And I'm like, oh my God, is he going to be like the villain of this movie? Because this movie just got better with his presence. And I mean, you have Wesley Snipes having this big like martial arts fight, you know, basically over these platforms at this party on New Year's Eve. And I'm like, this is really silly, and this is kind of fun. And then we get him like base jumping off the building in a very year 2000 CG sequence. And I'm like, okay, I can have fun with this. And then the movie just hits the brakes and is like, you've had enough fun. That's enough for now, folks. Let's get to like Donald Sutherland and Ann Archer in rooms talking about very boring events.
And we're pivoting into dislikes already. I feel like we should hit the brakes a little bit, don't you?
Probably. We should probably be hitting the brakes like the movie does, yeah.
Well, I mean, that is a hard pivot, though. I said it in my top line review as well. Like, as soon as he does that base jump, that's it.
Yeah.
The film is never fun again.
Is this like, okay, so there's like Jump the Shark. This is like Jump the New Year's Eve Party.
You need to shorten it down.
I know.
Have a little think about it during recording.
Jump the Building is too generic.
I've got it. Jump the Trump.
Oh. Done.
Now, yeah, I do want to talk more about Donald Sutherland's catatonic state throughout this film, but I'll save that for the dislike section. Let's talk about some good things. There are some redeeming qualities. I did mention the intro, so did you. So we could say that sort of Bond pre-title sequence style intro is actually a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Like if the rest of the film was this, I think we would be having a serious fun discussion about the Art of War.
It would be like kind of a trashy Bond film. Like Bond movies are kind of like the A grade in terms of that kind of spy storytelling. But like this would be kind of the bargain basement, although it's still an expensive movie. But I think this movie may have cost about the same as Goldeneye, which is like criminal. But like, you know, like just as to the evidence on screen, it would be kind of like the trashy Bond take, which could be fun. Like I would definitely have a lot more enjoyment out of watching Wesley Snipes have ridiculous stunts and martial arts fights than ultimately what I got in this thing.
Were they just using piles of money to prop up a sleeping Donald Sutherland?
I think it's fascinating that this movie has Ann Archer and Donald Sutherland on screen, and you are convinced they are first-time actors.
Yeah. Yeah, it's rough going, but we'll get... Okay, I'll throw it to you first. I like, other than the pre-title sequence...
There are a couple things that I feel like injected the kind of energy I was hoping for. There are a couple action sequences or action beats along the way that are actually fun. There's one, for example, with a runaway vehicle and a truck driver who is really desperate to snort cocaine. And this truck driver is just trying to line up that snort as his, like, you know, truck is just barreling down the road and Wesley Snipes is hanging from said truck. And an assailant is in a car trying to smash against him. And I'm like, that's the kind of goofy creativity that this movie can have fun with and I enjoy. And it does not belong at all in a lot of what else is going on in this movie. But that's the kind of stuff I was on board for. Or even just like little fights where like Wesley Snipes will take down an assassin in a room with like a really cool finishing move or something like that. You know, taking it back to Kerry Hiroyuki Tagawa playing Shang Tsung. Like there are some real finish him kind of moments, or finish her in some cases as well, moments that I think are actually pretty fun to see on screen. Like they have that pulpy kind of vibe. But like they kind of stand alone. And I would say one of the key aspects of that, I think there's one person that gets the vibe of the movie that I want to see.
Go on.
And that is Michael Biehn.
Yeah.
Who plays a team member of Wesley Snipes. Seems potentially to be modeled on Vanilla Ice. Not sure. It was the year 2000, folks. I don't know. But like Michael Biehn is giving a very like kind of goofy performance. And
it's arch.
I was like,
it's very arch.
He's very arch. And he is at a certain point, you know, spoilers, revealed to be one of the bad guys involved in this whole conspiracy. And that leads to like a really goofy fight where it's him and Wesley Snipes shooting point blank at each other.
And then missing completely.
Yeah. And then like sitting back to back and reloading their guns and talking. And ultimately the guy takes like a throat full of glass. And I'm like, you know what? That's the kind of trashy stuff that I can have fun with. And Michael Biehn seems locked in on that kind of energy. Like he seems to have signed up thinking he is playing, you know, a henchman in a B movie.
Yeah.
And he knows how to deliver this. And he does. So, like, every time they kind of worked in that kind of world, I was having more fun. Or even, like, in the very ridiculous, I'm assuming, homage to White Men Can't Jump, where it's Wesley Snipes and Michael Biehn playing basketball, and Wesley Snipes going flying through the air. Very, very silly scene. But
yeah,
it was enjoyable and completely clashing with the, like, Donald Sutherland exposition on either end of it.
And also the other serious hacker man moments and things like that. Yeah, I completely agree about Michael Biehn. I've always called him Bane. Is it Biehn?
I think it's Biehn, but don't 100% quote me, but I think that's what I've heard.
Let us know. Have we Biehned it or have we Biehned it? Mm. We are curious to find out, but we love him either way. Probably the best bit about this film. He completely gets the role, and that showdown in the UN building, which has very little security, and when I say very little, I mean none.
Yeah.
Is great. I mean, I'm pretty sure I've seen that shootout in the corridor where they're missing each other at point blank range before.
Sure.
In some sort of like hilarious action movie compilation.
Well, there's some Matrix going on there as well, because that's when you're seeing like the bullet time bullets. Yeah.
Yeah. That moment probably cost a lot of money. I don't know how they miss each other. It's like that Naked Gun sequence where they're both shooting each other from either side of the bench.
Yeah. Totally.
And then, like, Leslie Nielsen finds a quarter during the shoot and, like, puts it in his pocket and then shoots the gun some more. That's a great film. I like this. Michael Biehn, I'll go with Biehn, is the MVP for me.
Mm.
Absolutely. The other thing I sort of want to call out is just the stunt work. There are some action sequences that look a little cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Which is odd for an expensive film. There's a lot of like driving sequences where they're using green screen backdrops or like a rolling backboard type thing that look pretty bad.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that chase with the truck driver who wanted to finish off his line of cocaine. If you look at the passengers in that other van that Wesley Snipes was in, you'll find apart from the driver, everyone else was a crash test dummy.
Yeah.
No word of a lie, folks, and this clip is in HD on YouTube if you can track it down. I'll try and post it during the week. It's so obvious that they're crash test dummies. They even have the little markers on their face.
It's so weird, though, what this movie's doing, where, as I said, like there's a lot of fugitive in this movie and a lot of like self-serious stuff in this movie. But then we're now talking about like a scene with a truck driver trying to like finish his cocaine, like careening all over the road. And I'm like, that is not the sort of thing that works in, say, The Fugitive.
No, well, The Fugitive doesn't have a comedy line to it. It's a straight drama.
Well, the comedy comes more from, like, Tommy Lee Jones quips and things, yeah.
Like, it's situational stuff based on humanity and sort of a bit of Schadenfreude, whereas this is more... This film works when it's wacky.
Yeah, but does it think it's a wacky movie? Because, like...
No.
The convoluted plot of this, dealing with, like... Chinese trade agreements with the US gets like very, very bogged down in details. And there's like all these characters, you know, like Tagawa's David Chan, the James Hong character. There's a lot of conspiracy elements, but like the ultimate conspiracy is incredibly simplistic, but they bog it down in so many details and not in an interesting way. You and I have talked about conspiracy films. I think of like The Parallax View, which is very like detail oriented in terms of, you know, he's a reporter in that. So he's like putting details together, but the movie is constantly like goosing you with interesting developments or suspense sequences. This movie is like, Action scene, bore them into submission. Action scene, bore them into submission.
But it's not even a case of where, like, the audience is aware of the plot and the protagonist isn't. We're all none the wiser.
Yeah.
And sometimes that is a useful way of doing it. You're uncovering the mystery with the protagonist and you're following it through with them. That's usually the way things are done. Or you give some sort of tease at the beginning and you go from there. But this film makes a point to completely obfuscate the entire plot. And so you don't know why Wesley Snipes is doing stuff even when he is doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He has an internal monologue that you can't hear. He often gets to, like, talk about it through other characters. And one thing I noted was there was a lot of, like, stacking and exposition drops in this film where they would keep restacking the stakes. Like, if we go in that room, you know what will happen. And then someone else would be like, don't go in that room, you know what will happen. And you're just telling us that. You're not showing us anything.
Yeah.
And that is a real detriment to the film. I think before we get to dislikes, I have one final like I want to throw in.
Yes, please.
I am so impressed with how little Donald Sutherland cares.
That is head-scratching, because I think, like, we saw Donald Sutherland in the Mechanic remake.
Mm-hmm.
Look, that is not a high-prestige picture, and Donald Sutherland seems invested. I have rarely seen an actor of his caliber seems so just, like, awkward on screen.
I was just taking a look at what he was doing this year, and I don't know the films, but Panic and Space Cowboys, were they particularly big films?
Space Cowboys was, yeah, that's a Clint Eastwood film.
Right, okay. And then the next year he does Final Fantasy The Spirits Within, so he it wasn't one for good choices around this time.
Space Cowboys was a hit, but Final Fantasy... The thing about Final Fantasy was that movie was clearly like a bomb, but it was a very ambitious animated film, so there was actually...
I actually saw it in theaters.
So did I.
Weirdly.
So did I. Yeah. That was a tough one. But like...
Those spirits remained within.
Yes. But like, I think the execution versus what people were expecting it might be were different things.
Yeah, that's probably fair. Having the games were very popular in the 90s, and I was sort of going off of the 7 and 8, really, hoping it'd be more like that. But yeah, it's just so weird seeing the guy who was in, like, Eye of the Needle.
Yeah.
And The Eagle Has Landed, that sort of dynamic, vibrant character actor in this, practically asleep. I don't think he ever gets past the 2.
No. I mean, his character is ultimately completely useless in the movie, because he's like a Canadian Secretary General at the United Nations.
Already useless. Yeah.
But like, there's like nothing for him to do. He's confused. He doesn't know what's going on. He's not part of the conspiracy. And so it's a lot of him just hemming and hawing about what to do. And there's a point in the movie where, like, he just starts having doubts. And I just wrote a note that says, Sutherland having doubts. Z.
I don't know what film he thought he was in, because actually performances like his are some of the ones that bring it down for me. Not just in how little he cares, because I'm not saying the script is any good that gives him anything anyway, but the job of a character actor in my book in this sort of film is to come in and breathe a bit of life into these pointless, like, courtroom scenes or mahogany boardroom scenes where people are talking about the spy plot. You look at something like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Right, not a film that we've covered, but a film that I have actually watched.
Yeah.
And there are boardroom scenes that are magnetic.
Yeah.
You talk about Spy Game, boardroom scenes that are magnetic. Robert Redford is the lead, of course, of the film, or the co-lead. And he, of course, inserts a lot of dynamism into those scenes. But Donald Sutherland is, I'm pretty sure if I look him up, he's probably won some awards.
Oh,
he's a good actor.
Yeah.
He should be able to bring something to this role, and I could cast my auntie in what he performed.
It's not just him, though. Ann Archer is also, like, really rough. Ann Archer, who was in, like, the Jack Ryan films, we're going to see her play Harrison Ford's wife.
Yeah.
In Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger. And then she was also Michael Douglas's wife in Fatal Attraction. Like, these are big movies, and I'm totally familiar with Ann Archer, but I was watching this movie going, like, she's terrible in this. Like, this is a brutal performance. And you have her and Sutherland next to each other, and you're like, I don't understand how, like, decades of acting talent are producing material this bad.
I tell you what, Cam, this week, They are both being real Coke Zeros.
They are indeed, yes.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Red Alert, Spyhards, we are shaking things up over on the Patreon page.
That's right, we are launching an exclusive new show where we tackle the exploits of the small screen's greatest secret agents, like Jack Bauer, George Smiley, and beyond.
And don't forget, every month you also get two Agents in the Field episodes where we decode the adventures of your favorite spy actors in their biggest non-spy movies. But Cam, tell the people what we have coming up next.
Well, we've dodged this bullet long enough. It's time to return to the world of Remo Williams with the failed TV pilot from 1988, Remo Williams, The Prophecy. Will we become masters of Sinanju or get our butts kicked? Find out.
So don't get left out in the cold. Help support your favorite spy movie podcast and join the circus at patreon.com/spyhards. But before this message self-destructs, let's get back to the spy jinx. Oh no, here comes the Y2K bug. Let's talk about dislikes.
Why don't you start with this one?
Yeah, sure, I can lead us off. I mean, we've mentioned a lot of them, and we can always dive back in to talk about some things some more. But one I don't think we've spoken enough about is the sheer lack of character work in this film.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea who anyone is.
Yeah.
I have no idea what the plot is either, which doesn't help. But I can't tell you anything about Wesley Snipes' character, so much to the fact that I had to just quickly, whilst I was talking, flick to the IMDb page to check that his character was named Shaw. I couldn't remember the name of the lead character in this film.
What do we know about him? He plays basketball.
Mm-hmm. He is getting a bit too old for this SHIT.
Yeah, obviously the whole job part we know, like, we know he's an agent with the UN and stuff like that.
Sure.
But even like we have scenes with him and his team, mm-hmm. you know, Michael Biehn and then Liliana Komorowska, but they have no real dynamic.
No,
but we see that, like, he has a bit of a dynamic with Michael Biehn's character. The two of them spend some time together, but beyond that, you don't have like that True Lies kind of hangout vibe between the three of them where you go, oh, I can understand how they care about each other. Or even a movie that wasn't very good, Heart of Stone, mm-hmm. where, you know, we have some four scenes together of her and her team before they're wiped out. And it may be very one-dimensional, but you at least go, like, I can understand who those other characters were.
Yeah.
In this case, like, I don't know really anything about any of them. I couldn't figure out why the Novak character was making all those missing cat posters. Like, it's clearly, like, there's a code on them, but I didn't understand why she was doing that.
It's never really spelled out. And I'm also, like, chastising the film for, like, telling us instead of showing us, right?
Yeah.
But they didn't do either. They just did these cat things, and we never really understood what they were about. And that was a whole, like, three scenes.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, like, I understand there's a code on these posters, but why is she printing like 50 posters and like leaving them on her counter with a photo of the cat that I see she has in her apartment?
Yeah, never really explained, just sort of hinted towards. But it goes further than that. Like, I can forgive people like Donald Sutherland and Ann Archer's characters not having a lot of color to them.
Sure.
Right? I can get past that. They are like the M and the Money Penny or whatever you want to call them. They're the office people, right? But our lead, I don't know anything about the guy. And I can't remember what episode it was a while ago, but, you know, you took me to task, or I took you to task, about one of the films we were talking about. And you said, you can't tell me a single thing about the lead character. And I couldn't. And you were right.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But, you know, you can tell me stuff about James Bond.
I think that was Heart of Stone, actually, about the lead character of Heart of Stone.
Right. Okay. Well, there we go. Sort of disables your own argument from a moment ago, but we'll go with it because
no, that was about the team. The team you knew about them as people, yeah.
Well, sure. Like, what is his favorite drink?
Don't know.
You know, you could have put that in. Why did he get into the job? You could chuck that in a scene whilst he's driving or something like that. Like, oh, why did you want to be an agent?
Yeah.
Like, you can add some sort of idea as to what's driving this character, because right now all he's doing is working for good, right, in the American way, which is fine in like the first draft of your script, but by like the third draft, you need to have some sort of idea of the core principles and beliefs that drive your protagonist. Because otherwise, if you don't know, if the writer can't tell me this, the audience won't know.
Well, there's even like, okay, so Wesley Snipes has that basketball scene with Michael Biehn where he's injured, right?
Yeah.
And then we cut to the next scene of him talking to Ann Archer and he has like a beard and everything. And then the next scene, it's gone.
Which is never explained.
It's that he comes back in the next scene and he's shaven again. He looks exactly like he did during that basketball scene and earlier in the film. And I'm like, I guess he had the beard because he was off work for a long time. But like, it felt like they did a reshoot and Wesley Snipes refused to shave or something.
We've actually got a film coming up in a few weeks where we've recorded the episode already. We've done this slightly out of order. And the lead at one point decides to completely change their complexion, let's say it that way, and put on a beard to blend in, which is used for all of one scene, and it's done for comedic effect. At least the film tells you that that's for, so he can go undercover. In this film, you have no idea why he's completely changed his look for one scene only.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like you're talking about the lack of character, but maybe that would have been a reason to give us some insight into his character. Like, what is this man doing for his time off? I don't know. Is he like a very spiritual man who has been going on retreats or is just like very, you know, kind of having the Zen time to himself? Like, I don't know. I don't know anything about him.
No. These little things aren't necessarily important to the plot, but they're important to character. And character are what you cling to when you haven't got a good plot. And unfortunately, this film has no character development or plot. So this is why you spend almost 2 hours of this film looking at your watch.
Yeah, and it also just, like, totally wastes, like, you know, Tagawa and James Hong, like, they show up, and the movie is kind of, it's like, this is a movie about China and its relationship to the U.S., but then it very quickly dismisses its Chinese characters, although Tagawa is Japanese, not Chinese, but it was the era, folks, they, you know, whatever, mixed and matched when it came to casting, but, like, these are very charismatic actors who are just kind of like, yeah, they're important. Oh, wait, no, they're not. This movie's about, you know, our American characters.
Well, I want to hear from you. What's something you want to point out in the dislikes?
I mean, I mentioned earlier, but like there's a real problem with the pairing up of your lead, Wesley Snipes, and this character, Julia. Because like Julia is a character who, if Wesley Snipes is impenetrable, she needs to be our avatar to kind of bring us into this world the way that, you know, we see in Jason Bourne, Marie, like that's very much how she operates in that film.
She is scared when he isn't scared, but we would be scared in that scenario.
And she's the one who's able to get answers out of him and find facts out along the way, even through experiences. Mm-hmm. And in this case, this character, there's one point where I was like, I was just laughing because it's like this kind of like tender moment of Wesley Snipes like miking her up and being like, you'll be able to, you know, hear and talk to me while I go do this little journey into this gentleman's club. And then he like cuts very to this harsh moment of just like handcuffing her to the wheel and walking away. And I'm like, okay, like they kind of tried to sell this as like a kind of tender moment. Smash cut to, nope, you're disposable to me. See you later. And you never have that... those scenes of her getting any sort of insight into what's going on. She's someone who has like stakes in this. Her friend was first attacked and then later killed by assassins.
Mm-hmm.
She should want answers and be really driven to want to find them along with him. And he should see the value in that. But no, he does not. He is like, you are an annoyance.
I totally get going for like the chalk and cheese approach of having two people that don't get on. And you have to sort of put them into the scenario where they have to work together to get to the end goal. That's absolutely fine. But what also didn't help is these two didn't have any good chemistry.
No.
Between them, that really didn't help. And I do want to... One person we haven't really aimed our sights at is, you know, Canada's answer to Hong Kong directors. The one and only Christian Duguay?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I like Duguay. Could be that. I mean, he's from Montreal, so it could be French pronunciation.
Sure.
I think a lot of the problems are squarely at his feet.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have Donald Sutherland in your film, and he gives you a completely unconvincing, unenthused performance. A lot of that is your director.
Yeah.
You need to get those performances out of your actors. You've you've cast two people in your leads who have no chemistry, then you need to recast that lady.
Yeah.
Or coach them into having better scenes together. This is all down to the director. And there was a moment I found almost unforgivable in this. And this isn't like a... We can turn it into a joke. But like, there's a lot of work with trackers in this film, right? A lot of people get implanted with trackers. Wesley Snipes gets implanted with a tracker in his shoulder.
Yeah.
Now, the film can choose where it puts its trackers. But the film, for some reason, decides to sort of say, oh, in her clothes might be a tracker, so you have to take all of your clothes off.
Yeah.
And they make her sit there in the car for several scenes that would have taken at least a day, maybe 2 days to shoot, where she's completely in the nude, except for, I imagine, some modesty bits and bobs down below.
Yeah.
And I just think, like, what? Who is this for? Is it for the teenage boys that are going to see this film? Okay, I can understand...
or weren't going.
Who didn't turn up. I can understand trying to appeal to those people.
Yeah.
But you should be trying to raise the bar here, not lower it.
Did you notice that scene where there's like the dangler thing on the mirror in the car of like the topless woman?
Mm-hmm.
And the camera keeps focusing on it in scenes?
Yep.
I was like, that is really distracting. And they just keep going to it over and over again.
To be fair, this film didn't really over-sexualize much else apart from... I really should say her name to give her some credit because she was in a film. Marie Matiko, who played Julia, I keep just saying she. She did as much as she could with it, I think. But like, I just find that like just gratuitous.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a sort of person that's like, adverse to nudity in films. I think it can serve a purpose. I'm not adverse to lovemaking scenes in films either. I think they can serve a purpose if directed and written well. Her taking her clothes off and being made to sit around naked and be all uncomfortable, it just made me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I didn't need that also pushing me away whilst the rest of the film was trying to push me off the cliff too.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, you have the scene of, like, Wesley Snipes going to, like, the gentleman's club where there's, like, all the, you know, the nude women. But you're like, well, this is a brothel. This kind of makes sense for the world he'd be wandering into.
That contextualized made sense, yeah.
I'm not going to say that it wasn't being showcased because the movie wanted those kind of cheap thrills. I think that may have been very much on the table. But that scene at least makes sense within the logic of the movie. Whereas, like, yeah, like, the whole, like, stripping her down, it's like... At the very least, it would be like, strip her down, but then, like, here's a coat. Like, whatever. You know, it would not be played as prolonged.
Yeah, he's actually wearing a shirt and jacket and doesn't offer her a jacket.
Yeah. He's a real jerk. Like, that's the whole point that they build this kind of, like, what they think is a romance by the end of the movie. I'm like, no, you did not earn this whatsoever.
Well, I have a theory. Will you indulge my theory?
Please.
I think that Julie... That's the character's name, played by Marie Matiko, who I'm mentioning again. Likes a bit of the rough stuff.
Oh, okay.
She likes being handcuffed for some reason.
Sure.
And the thing that you just mentioned as well. You know, she keeps coming back, and by the end she loves him. I think she's a bit of a masochist.
She does show up at the start of the movie in like kind of this like punk rock hairstyle.
Yeah.
That she then removes and never mentions again for the rest of the movie. And you're like, okay.
That had Cam's interest for all the 5 seconds.
Yeah, but it's like, okay, maybe that does point towards maybe a more alternative lifestyle than the movie really sells.
The way Cam just said it, like the more alternative lifestyle, he is definitely... they say like the Brits are stuffy. I mean, look at the Canadian in the room, man. What is that about?
I'm a real Donald Sutherland. I'm falling asleep right now.
I should prop you up with more money. But I suppose then I'll throw to any final notes. I have a couple of little bits and bobs. Why don't you take the lead?
Well, I had a question just before I'll mention some of my moments. Did that scene towards the end of the movie where they were cutting between flashbacks and the events of a chase, did that just seem particularly like gaudy to you?
It was just too much.
Yeah.
And also, like, weirdly, it made both hard to follow.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, you've seen those techniques in, like, John Woo films or Tsui Hark films. Mm-hmm. But, like, they know how to do it well. This was a case of a filmmaker drawing on a lot of Asian influences in filmmaking and not knowing how to employ them whatsoever.
I'll also throw to Chris Nahon, who directed Kiss of the Dragon. He took a lot of influence from Hong Kong cinema for that film. And you can feel that influence in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But he does it right.
Yeah.
It's not a great film, but it's a damn sight better than this.
Oh, it definitely is. So I've got a few other notes I will mention. Mm-hmm. the opening credits look like 2001 A Space Odyssey, when it was like the colors and like the light tripping sequence, and then they zoom out and it's like a sign. But I was like, this is a weird way to set a vibe for this movie.
I originally ended up watching this film in like Spanish because it didn't talk for a while. I got about 5 minutes in before I realized it was in Spanish. So I actually watched those credits three times in the end.
A moment I thought was very uncomfortable was you have this like corrupt, I don't know, military figure.
Did your mum walk in during the undressing scene?
No. It's the corrupt like general or something who's at that New Year's Eve party, and he's with like a bunch of women.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, it starts turning into, like, a oral sex scene.
Uh-huh.
And you have Novak, who's a member of Wesley Snipes' team, say, 13 and 14-year-olds, he's disgusting. And then the camera starts leering at what is going on as, like, Michael Biehn is like, oh, wow. Oh, wow. And I'm like, you just told us those are 13 and 14-year-olds. I'm sorry. I am in a very different state of mind right now than the trashy movie you think I'm watching.
Maybe that's just a film setting up that Michael Biehn was the bad guy.
I mean, it probably is, showing he's completely immoral, but like the way that they film that is very exploitive. If they are indeed, as the movie is saying, you know, underage people.
If the two scenes that we mentioned earlier weren't enough evidence, Exhibit A is here, right at the start of the film.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's setting the tone as to like that this movie's kind of just like a garbage movie.
And remember, folks, this was in the part that we liked.
Yeah.
Not for that reason. Don't get any thoughts about that.
We also had, actually, I thought, kind of interesting, Wesley Snipes doing a Eddie Murphy impression off the top. Very goofy stuff. And
yeah,
that may be the one moment in the entire film where Wesley Snipes kind of like...
comes to life?
Opens up a bit? Yeah, like comes to life and does something a little unusual or wacky.
I know they were together in Coming to America too, but was he in the original Coming to America as well?
I don't think so. He was in the sequel, yeah, okay. But I don't think he was in the original.
I wonder if they worked together before that point.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, but it was, this is why, and this leads back to something I said earlier. I had such high hopes in that first 10 minutes. Like, this guy is basically being suave, but kind of cool, and like an American James Bond, and kicking ass, and taking names, and then Donald Sutherland.
Well, it's like you have... not just Donald Sutherland. It's like, yeah, you've got like, you know, quips and like bizarre Michael Biehn moments and all that sort of goofy stuff up front. Cut to like container full of dead refugees. And you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay.
Oh my. Okay.
Mm.
That kind of movie, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. I also want to note just one of my favorite cliches that is in this movie is that chase sequence that we get into the same location twice. It ends in like a warehouse or whatever it is, like an industrial site where there's sparks pouring everywhere. One of my favorite cliches.
It's like every Nine Inch Nails music video.
That's right. That's right.
Mm. I have three notes to mention. The first one is, if you're keeping track of the website they visit a bunch of times, it is eensnsn.com.
Which, of course, was taken from those cat poster code things. Yeah,
absolutely. And I checked, it's available, folks, if you want to buy the website.
How much? That's got to be a cheap one, right?
It's cheap. It's like, I think, like $40 for a year. we should buy it and redirect to spyhards.com.
That'd be amazing. Or we just build a Art of War tribute site,
but we do it like 2000s GeoCities.
I was thinking that,
with like the trailer, like the mouse cursor that follows you everywhere, and everything's got like fire gifs.
Yeah, and a counter.
Yeah, and a counter for visits. Yeah. Perfect. My next note was, this film has an ungodly amount of shots of men, specifically Wesley Snipes, falling from height.
That is also true, yes.
I don't know what was who the stunt coordinator was for this film. I should probably take a look and see if I can find out who it was. But I think they just had a thing for trying to make men falling from height shots look impressive.
Yeah, the second unit director was Jeff Ward. I'm not exactly sure who the stunt director was.
Oftentimes it's one and the same.
Yeah.
Jeff Ward worked on Hellboy, The Five Bloods, Blade 2, Shooter... very busy guy.
Yeah, and I should note, actually, this movie was edited by Michel Archand, who edited Tomorrow Never Dies.
Wow, okay. Well, that's a Spymaster interview waiting to happen.
Yeah, and also that's a very Asian movie influenced James Bond film. A lot of Hong Kong action kind of elements going on there.
I'll take a note of their name and see what I can do with it. But that leads me over to my last note. And this is a bit of a doozy. Prepare yourself. I'm proposing a cinematic universe.
Oh, I'm out.
Okay. Now, Wesley Snipes' character Shaw works for the UN Covert Operations Unit. Who do you think founded the unit?
Someone who's like, my unit is the very best.
Have a think about it. You'll hit yourself in the head.
I'm trying to think of something related to the UN in a movie we tackled. I don't know.
I propose that Cary Grant, aka Roger Thornhill, created this team back in the North by Northwest film when he ended up pretending to be the guy who worked at the UN.
Oh my God.
And was accused of being a spy.
Oh my God. I don't want to see this movie.
Alfred Hitchcock was responsible for The Art of War.
It was influenced by Hitchcock, according to Wesley Snipes. So, well, there you have it. I mean, I guess this does have that wrong man sort of vibe as well, but it's a little more. I mean, come on. Wesley Snipes is not your everyman, that's for sure.
We all wish we were Wesley Snipes. But yeah, that's my theory, that Roger Thornhill created the UNCO.
Okay.
He's the original man from UNCO.
There was a point in this movie where we had a lot of scenes of Donald Sutherland being like, we may have to get the president to intervene. We may have to get the president to intervene. And then he's like, I think I'm going to have to get the president to intervene. And it meant nothing. I was like, okay, sure.
Did his performance just give you like vibes of Bruce Willis in his last few years of filmmaking? Where he's just like doing, yeah, he's not got the receiver in his ear. I think Donald probably learned his lines and did his job on the day. But like, Bruce wasn't taking direction at that point because he couldn't take direction at that point, what we've come to learn.
Yeah.
And so Donald was just reciting the lines. Like, he was just an automaton.
Yeah. Because like, yeah, Bruce Willis, we now know the experience he was going through, and it suddenly all makes logical sense what we were seeing. But for years, we didn't have a clue. And so the types of performances you were seeing very much felt aligned with what you see from Donald Sutherland here, yes.
Well, I think that pretty much wraps up our chat about The Art of War, apart from one final question.
Oh, I did have one point. At the end, we have them like going off together, and then we see that there's a photographer taking a photo of them, which seems to be like teasing that like they're still on the run. So do you think like that was basically a tease for like if this movie was a big hit, they were going to make a follow-up?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Art of War 2, Revenge of Someone.
I mean, I guess we'd have to watch Art of War 2, Betrayal to see if it carries those threads.
I just don't think we do. I don't think we do. Unless Roger Thornhill turns up as like some sort of Avengers-style UN reunion, I don't think I'm in for it.
The problem is I would be okay doing it, like even on the small screen on Patreon or something. But the problem is I've watched some of these direct-to-video sequels. There's nothing fun about them. They are completely generic and boring. So like, why are you sitting through them?
No, I don't think we should put people through that either, right? I saw the download numbers for Cats and Dogs 2 and 3. I think I've made my peace with just doing the first one.
Fair enough, yes.
Okay, knocklist time. I think this might be one of the easiest ones. Is The Art of War making the knock list? Cam, over to you.
The only way this is getting a yes from me is if I am that truck driver careening down the street snorting cocaine.
That's an image I'll never shake from my head, but I only see you for a few hours a day, a few days a week, so I don't know what keeps you awake the rest of the time.
Right, so it's a big no.
It's a big no. Okay, and as for me, I won't belabor the point, it's also a no. This might be the worst spy film I've seen so far this year.
Oh, okay, so it's not the worst we've done on the show.
No.
There's been movies that were worse, but like this year, I don't think there's anything I would put up against it.
No. There's been some, like, mediocre films, but this is actively bad at times.
So, does that mean that...
I was going to ask the question. A question that hasn't been asked in quite some time. Is The Art of War going to be disavowed? Now, if you haven't heard about the disavowed list, if you're just a new joiner, a new listener on the show, the disavowed list is the worst of the worst. Whatever is the opposite of the creme de la creme. It is the pits of spy movies. It's the ones that you wouldn't even tell your worst enemy about. So far, there's only a handful of films that have been bad enough to make it, and Cam has a special weapon he used to help induct films onto the list. So I'll ask the question. Are we disavowing The Art of War?
This is a tough one, because my initial reaction after watching the movie was, no, this is just kind of like a very bad, forgettable action movie. But now I'm like sitting here and I'm like, well, hold on. Like, is this movie better than Taken 3?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that it is. Like, Taken 3 was lousy too. And also, like, that movie was probably a little less boring than this movie is.
I would much rather watch Men in Black 2 than watch this again.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
And also, okay, if you're going to make kind of this, like, kind of trashy, kind of schlocky spy action film, kind of conspiracy thriller
thing.
Well, even if you're not going to make it fun, even if it's not going to be very good, like something like The Mechanic Resurrection is more entertaining.
Because it's fun.
That one is
or
actually
schlocky,
pretty campy,
at least.
Yeah.
Like it is like, yeah, it's not balls to the wall, but it, you know, I actually watched it again recently when I was in Mexico, and it's just unhinged at times. Jason Statham tries to outswim a shark.
No one in this movie seems to be having fun except for Michael Biehn.
No. He is the one thing that if we had a guest on this episode, I would hope someone throws against us in terms of the disavowed list. But I think this is... I mean, you could probably point out a couple of good performances in Men in Black 2.
Yeah.
Rosario Dawson does her best with that film.
And just like the handling of the conspiracy story in this movie is just... dire stuff.
It's bungled.
Did you watch this one twice, or did you just like?
Yeah,
you did.
I watched it twice, brother.
Oh my god, I can't imagine.
Yeah, I was at war with myself. Well, in terms of the disavowed list, Cam, I'm gonna say yes. What about you?
I'm willing to follow your lead on this one because, like, at the time, I felt one way, but now it's like, hey, Cam, I want you to rewatch Art of War. For whatever, some sort of reason, we're going to do a roundtable on the Art of War series. I'd be like, I don't want to rewatch it. And so, like, that tells me something right there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that says it all you need to say. So, without further ado, let's disavow that sucker.
There we go.
There you go. That's a first time in 2024 we've disavowed a film. First time in quite a while.
Yeah. And also, like, I would rather watch, like, Bullet to Beijing, the Harry Palmer film, than this.
Yeah. At least you've got Michael Caine trying in that film.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a shame. What a shame. But there you go, folks. The Art of War did not make the knock list, but don't worry. It's been sent to the depths of hell, the list of the worst spy films of all time, the disavowed list.
That's right.
Well, Cam, the question now goes to you. We have stepped out of the Wesley Snipes fire. What are we on to next week?
Well, we are re-enlisting with the Uncle guys to hang out with Robert Vaughn and David McCallum with the second Man from U.N.C.L.E. theatrical feature, The Spy with My Face from 1965.
So there you go, folks. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to join us next time here on Spy Hards as we take a look at 1965's The Spy with My Face. And good golly, most spies would not wish to have my face. If you like what you heard on this episode, please consider supporting us over on our Patreon, patreon.com/spyhard. There's a link in the show notes below. A ton of bonus episodes, over 50 bonus episodes at this point, film commentaries, spy TV show reviews, and just film reviews as well. Lots to enjoy. And plus, you'll be helping keep the lights on here at Spy Hards HQ. And frankly, the prices keep going up for our hosting service, for how we, the services and software we use to record this. So every little bit helps. Trust us, you will be making a difference. Any donation helps. So thank you for that. And make sure you follow us discreetly, as always, on social media at SpyHards. That's SpyHards on Facebook. I don't know, Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it. And Instagram. But until next time, folks, it's time for some aggressive peacekeeping.